Thank you. Good morning. Hang on, I gotta catch my breath. I had some steps to climb. I should really quit smoking. Really nice to be here, especially in January. I like cold weather, and thanks to Tony for bringing me in. I know he's into climbing, and at least he'll like the show, right? And we're gonna do some climbing together next year. But I really love hanging out with groups like you, and more importantly, get to talk about what I've been doing and share some of the stories and some of the lessons. And I think what we do in the mountains has a lot of transferable lessons about, you know, life and business and all that. And I'm going to share some of that with you now. And to give you the feeling of what it's like up there, we're actually going to close the doors now. We're going to refrigerate the room and we're going to suck the oxygen out. But I've been climbing now since the late 70s. And for me, initially, it was a hobby and very passionate about it. I still love going out there and climbing. And the problem was that I was doing it so much and gone so much on these expeditions that I couldn't hold down a normal job. So I eventually had to say, I've got to figure out how to turn this into a profession. You know, going and climbing and somehow earning a living while doing that. And nobody was doing that here in the U.S., so I had to kind of invent it. But I managed to do it. Raising money and earning a living as a climber was even harder than the actual climbing. But that's what I do now, and that's what I got to do for my adult life. And this is where I got to go to work. This is my office. A great view, as you can imagine, but a hell of a commute as well. And, you know, the big question a lot of people ask is why do I do this? And more importantly, how could you do it for so long? Because it is hard. It's always hard. It's not necessarily fun, but we have a twisted sense of what fun is. But I think what I like about it, and I think what you have to embrace, especially in mountaineering, is to embrace the process. Because we go on one of these bigger expeditions, if it's Mount Everest or one of the highest peaks in the world, that singular event could last 3 months just to climb one mountain. And prior to that singular event, we prepare for that event for up to 6 to 8 months. Training, logistics, raising the money, putting a team together, that whole process, you know, if you look at it all together, could be a 9-month process to climb one single mountain. So you have to enjoy that process. Once you get to the mountain, then you're tested. All that investment of time and energy and training is now how you're going to be tested as you're climbing the mountain. And as you get closer to your goal, as you get higher toward the summit, it gets harder. It's almost as if the mountain is trying to prevent you from success. And because of that, you have to be relentless. You have to be patient. You have to be comfortable being uncomfortable. And that's why we call this climbing, right? We don't call it summiting, because most of the time you're climbing and climbing and climbing. If things work out and if nothing goes wrong, you do get to the summit. And that's an amazing feeling. But out of that whole 9 month or whatever process, you might stand on the summit for an hour. But that's kind of your payback, right? This is this thing you've been testing yourself for and striving for. And when you're up there, it's very satisfying because then you look back on that entire engagement of time and energy, and you go, now I see that it's worth it, right? That's your payback, your moment of joy standing on the summit. And for me, that became very addicting. And again, you've got to like that journey and the process along the way. But there's never a guarantee of success. That's kind of the cool part of what we do. There's never a guarantee of success. Is there risk? Yes, there's always risk. And a lot of people question us as we go climbing. They think, oh, you guys love risk. Well, we don't love it. We accept it. And the biggest thing I learned as a climber was how to manage the risk, because you're always thinking about what if. And I break the risk into two different categories. There's the objective risk, the dangerous conditions out there, the avalanches and the storms and the pulmonary edema and all the things that you have to accept but you can't eliminate. But there's another category of risk which is manageable. And it's the bigger category, in my opinion. It's the subjective part of risk. It's decisions that you make based on success. You know, how much are you willing to invest or pay for that success? And as you can imagine, in the mountains, there's a lot of very ambitious and motivated and driven individuals that are out there doing these climbs. But you're also investing a lot. Money, time, expectation. And in the face of danger, a lot of people aren't willing to stop and turn around because you're out there, you're close to a summit, and even if conditions are bad, a lot of people aren't willing to turn around. It's almost like they have to summit at all costs. And that's what kills and injures most people in the mountains. It's not the avalanches and the storms, it's the choices that people make. And I had to learn early on how to temper my ambition. And the number one I kept telling myself is, you know, I love climbing, but I like being alive a lot more. And for me, climbing a mountain has to be a round trip. My number one goal is to get home. And after that, everything else is secondary. So risk management was the biggest thing that I learned how to do. And I never expected that I'd have to do that when I started climbing. And so about 15 years ago or so now, somebody suggested that I write a book. And I'd never really planned on writing a book, but in the end, I wanted to talk about the journey and the process. And for me, the overriding theme was that when we do something, especially in the mountains, you know, you can't buy success. You have to earn it. You have to pay for it somehow. And you don't want to take a shortcut. You want to look back on that process and that journey and feel good about that, you know, trail of footprints that you left behind. You know, how you did what you did, how you treated people. And I'm very happy with the book. It's done, you know, extremely well, surprisingly well. But I think I would have sold more had I changed the title to Shortcuts to the Top, right? What's the secret ingredient? But again, you know, I don't think we believe in taking shortcuts. You want to embrace the day-to-day process to get to success. So how did I start climbing? I read this book when I was a teenager, and it is the story that inspired me. And at the time, I was growing up in the great mountaineering state of Illinois. And I was reading adventure books, and I came across this mountaineering book. And it's the story of a group of climbers from France that in 1950 went to this mountain called Annapurna. Now, Annapurna is one of only 14 mountains, as was said earlier, in the world over 8,000 meters. 8,000 meters being 26,200 feet. And these 8,000ers are literally, you know, halfway around the world here on the map. They're in the Himalaya chain from western Pakistan all the way to eastern Nepal. And Annapurna is kind of right smack in the middle. And in 1950, when this team of French climbers went to Annapurna, none of the other 8,000-meter peaks had yet been climbed, not even Everest, although Everest had been attempted already for about 30 years. So if these guys could pull it off, it would be an amazing achievement, not only in mountaineering, but, you know, coming out of World War II for the country of France, they needed a little bit of uplift. And they had a pretty small team. They had seven climbers. They had a doctor, a base camp manager. They had some local support. But this team of seven climbers with what I thought was tremendous leadership and great teamwork, you know, through trial and tribulation for 3 months on this mountain, they worked together as a team, and in the end, they succeeded. But what happens is the whole team doesn't go to the summit. You know, when you sign up for one of these events, that probably only two of the team are going to get to the top. That's the way it works out, and that's something that you know going into it. But it's that team effort that creates success. And The leader, Maurice Herzog, and his partner were the two climbers then that stood on the summit. This was an amazing achievement in mountaineering in 1950. And I read that book, and I was so inspired by it, by the journey and the cool equipment and the adventure and that teamwork and the process. And I thought to myself, wow, that is something I want to do. And I had this dream and this vision then because of that book. And I said, okay, what do I need to do? Well, it's going to take a while. I know zero other than reading about climbing. It's going to take a while to train and to gain experience and to meet the right people. And I said, if I start right now, maybe in 10 years, I'll be ready to go to one of these big giant mountains. So a lot of steps I knew I had to take. And the first step I had to take was, you know, to get the hell out of Illinois. So right out of high school, I decided to move, and I moved to Seattle, Washington, primarily because I'd read so many great stories about American Himalayan climbers that got their start in the Pacific Northwest. And I also went to school there. I went to the University of Washington for 4 years because my other dream as a kid was to become a veterinarian. So 4 years undergrad and another 4 years to medical school, 8 years, and eventually I became a veterinarian. But during that time, I focused a lot of my free time and attention climbing in the Cascades, and more importantly on this mountain that you can see from downtown, Mount Rainier, 14,400 feet high. It is our iconic Pacific Northwest peak. And for me, this was the perfect training ground, the perfect classroom, because it had all the elements that I was looking to train for: high altitude, crappy weather, steep terrain, glaciers, snow, ice. And I was able to find people that were willing to take me into the mountains. You know, I needed to train and learn from people that had experience, but were also willing to take me and put me on the end of the rope. And that's how I learned how to climb, by just going out there and watching and listening and learning. And the big lesson we learned as well is that rope team, the brotherhood of the rope, we call it. Because when you connect with somebody on a rope in the mountains, you're safer and you're stronger. And you have to trust and rely on each other. But once that works, that synergy, you know, 1 + 1 = 3. And that's how that rope team energy comes across. But you got to imagine if you're roped together with 4 or 5 other people, you know, for 18 hours during a long day, there has to be synchrony as well. You know, you guys have to be as strong as each other. You got to be going in the same direction at the same pace. So there's a little bit of a learning curve as well. And after climbing and learning about climbing for about 4 or 5 years, I finally applied for and got a job to work as a guide on Mount Rainier. And that was way back in 1982. And I did that because it would be a great summer job. I'd be in the mountains all summer, and I worked there for 10 summers. And I took hundreds and hundreds of people to the top of Mount Rainier. And as a guide, I learned a lot of lessons as well. Not only how to take care of myself, but more importantly, how to take care of our customers. You know, their safety was paramount. You know, they come to us, we're selling a product. Hey, come climb Mount Rainier with us. And we do our very best to help them to achieve that goal. But safety and keeping them alive is priority number one. You know, second to that is to give them an amazing experience. No matter what happens, we want them to walk away, you know, different in a positive way. And obviously, we do try to get them to the summit, right? And the people that come to us, they have a lot of expectations. You know, they've trained for this, they're planning for this, they've spent money on this, they bought shiny new gear at REI. So there is a lot of expectation on their part, right? They're coming here to climb the mountain. But we as guides, you know, we do want to help them do that. But we also learn how to have what you call situational awareness. We are always evaluating everything by the moment. The weather, the snow, the wind, the strength of the team. Is somebody having an issue? And all of that information is helping us in the moment to make a decision. You know, do we keep going? Do we stop? Or do we turn around? Because ultimately, we aren't in charge. The mountain is actually the one that's in charge. And I think the biggest lesson that I learned as a guide was how to, what we call, listen to the mountain. Because it's telling us what we can do. And it's telling us what we should do as well. And that to me was one of the bigger lessons of my career. How to listen to the mountain and make decisions based not on my ambition, but based on what's allowing me to either proceed or to turn around. And because of my guiding, you know, I was surrounded by senior guides. And that was one of my things as well, as I wanted to learn from these guys that became my teachers and my mentors. And they were already, as well, climbing in the Himalaya. And I thought, if I work hard and show that I'm a good team member, maybe eventually they'll invite me to come on one of their bigger expeditions. And as I went climbing further and higher in the world, I started to dream maybe at one point I could climb Everest. You know, as a climber, that's on your list, typically. The highest point on Earth, 29,000 feet high. And so I read about the history of these mountains. So I learn about them, become familiar with them. And Everest has a pretty cool history. It was first climbed in 1953. After 30 years of effort, the British finally pulled it off. And there were 40 people on that expedition in 1953. And for 3 months, they worked together as a team. And in the end, only two people reached the summit. Edmund Hillary from New Zealand and Tenzing Norgay, the Sherpa. So in 1953, this was a huge event in human endeavor. I mean, just as big as, you know, landing on the moon in 1969. Two people reached the summit. So once again, that teamwork was the key ingredient. I think second to that, especially when you're climbing up to 29,000 feet, you know, one third the amount of oxygen up there, the use of supplemental oxygen was that second key ingredient. And what the use of oxygen does is it helps you to climb to those altitudes. You're warmer, you're stronger, you're faster, you think more clearly. And I truly believe that because the first ascent was done with oxygen, that then became kind of the standard or the norm. You know, you go to Everest, you want to get to the summit, you don't really care how you get there. Of course, you're going to use oxygen. And that's the norm on Everest these days. And I started to think about, you know, if I went to Everest or got the chance to go to one of these other giant Himalayan peaks, it was more important to me not just if I got to the summit, but how I got to the summit. And I thought the use of oxygen was kind of a contrived way of gaining success, because what oxygen actually does is it reduces the altitude of the mountain by about 7,000 feet. So you're kind of lowering it so that you can get to the top. And I don't have anything against, you know, people that use oxygen. It's a personal choice. But for me, I thought the only way I was going to climb one of these big mountains was without oxygen. Even if it meant never getting to the summit, I was not going to break down. I made this commitment that it had to be all or none, but it had to be without oxygen. And because of that, I knew it would be harder, chance of success would be less. But if I could pull it off, it would be more interesting, and it would be more rewarding. And it also would be cheaper. I wouldn't have to buy the oxygen, right? So with that in mind, I kept climbing and thinking, will this ever happen? And could I possibly even do this? So lo and behold, 10 years now into my career, I was for the first time invited to go on a Himalayan expedition by one of my mentors on Rainier. And he invited me to be on a team of seven people to go to climb the highest point on Earth. And to me, that was a great honor. And when you go to one of these big mountains in the Himalaya, you know, you can't drive to the bottom. You can't fly a plane to the bottom. The altitude is too high. So that means you have to walk to the bottom of these mountains. Anywhere from 8 days to 2 weeks of walking in the lower lands of the country that you're in to get yourself to base camp. And that's the way you get to the base camp of Everest. 8 days of walking. But what that allows you to do then is you immerse yourself into the country as well. You learn the language, you learn about the food, the religion, the culture. It's an amazing experience, and you try to embrace that. And then 8 days later, you then finally arrive at what's called base camp. This is just under 18,000 feet. And this is now where we as a team, we're going to live here and operate out of that base camp for almost 3 months. And with us now, we have to have brought all the supplies, all the food, all the equipment that then now this becomes our base of supply for the entire expedition. So you have to have a lot of attention to detail to make sure you have just enough, not too much, not too little, right? Because if you forgot something, there's no 7-Eleven around the corner where you can run and get something. So a lot of planning and logistics goes into just getting to base camp. And from here now begins the process of climbing the mountain. You know, we can't go from base camp to the summit in one day. It's too far and it's too high. What we need to do, though, is establish 4 camps above base camp. And that establishing of the camps and carrying the loads to those camps is what takes up the bulk of the time of the expedition, anywhere from 8 to 10 weeks. From there, then, we can launch ourselves from the 4th camp and go to the summit. But that's still 2 months away. So most of the time we are spending as a team now carrying loads of equipment to these camps. And so this is where everybody contributes. Right? Everybody has a role. Everybody has a responsibility to do their part to get this equipment up the mountain. Individually, we're expected, you know, to put a load on our back, 40, 50, 60 pounds, and carry these loads of equipment every day. So right out of the gates, we're working hard. And for the first 8 or 10 days, we might be going just up and down, back and forth, day after day, carrying loads to camp one. Once that camp is established, we set up the tents, fill them with supplies, and we might have 2 or 3 guys then occupy that camp, and then they start shuttling loads to camp two. And so this is like a supply chain, you guys are familiar with that, of stuff that we're sending up the mountain from this base camp. And it all goes up in a very orderly and timely and logistical fashion. So we're working really hard going up and down, back and forth, over and over, but that has to be done. What it also does, though, it allows us to acclimatize. Every time we go to a new altitude, it shocks our body into creating more red blood cells. We go to an altitude, we come down, and then we go back to that altitude and we feel even better. We go down, we go back to that altitude, we feel even better. But there's a limit. Once you start getting above 22, 23,000 feet, your body actually starts to deteriorate. And because of the lack of oxygen, you know, the amount of loads that we can actually physically carry goes down as well. By the time we reach the altitude of Camp 4, this is at 27,000 feet, you know, rather than being able to carry 60 pounds, we might be able to carry 20 pounds or less. So that supply chain starts to trickle. And rather than have 3 or 4 tents fully supplied with a lot of stuff, Camp 4 ends up being one little tiny tent with just enough supplies for 2 people. So again, that's how the logistics of this works. Even in 1953, with 35 people, they got one little tent up for 2 people. So we've established all the camps. We've done all that work. 8 weeks of effort. We're acclimatized. We're now ready, hopefully, to climb that last section from Camp 4 to the summit. So we come back down to base camp, relatively thick atmosphere of 18,000 feet. You know, we get our appetites back. We rest for a few days. And now we wait for what we hope is a 5-day window of good weather. Because we've got to send 2 people again to climb through those first 4 camps. And then hopefully on that final and fifth day, they'll climb to the summit. But that by far now is going to be the hardest day ahead of us. So once again, two people can occupy Camp 4. So we've got a decision to make. At base camp, we have a meeting. We've got to figure out who those two people are going to be that are going to represent the team. So the leader looks around the room and he sits us all down. He goes, who wants to go to the summit? Nobody raises their hand, right? Because right now you just want to go home because you're tired, you're homesick, you've lost 15 pounds. You know, all that motivation that you had in the bar 6 months ago is gone. How do you pick the two people that are going to now represent the team? Well, there's three criteria. Who's still strong? Who's still motivated? But more importantly, who's also contributed during that entire process, right? You can't pick somebody that's been sitting on the sidelines waiting and saving themselves. You have to find people that have actually rolled up their sleeves and contributed to that event. I was one of the two people selected. And I thought, wow, my first trip to Everest, and I get to try to go to the summit? So it's a great honor, but also imagine the pressure of expectation, right? You are the two guys now that hopefully will succeed after this huge amount of time and energy and investment. So we find a window of weather. We then leave base camp. We climb through those first four camps, and we spend one night at Camp 4. This is at 27,000 feet. And tomorrow is our big day. So it's a very short night. We get out of the tent 30 below zero at 1 o'clock in the morning, and we start the final day's ascent. And the reason we start so early is we know it's probably going to take 12 hours from that camp just to get to the summit, and another 6 hours or so to get back. So that's an 18-hour day. That's a long round trip. And we start in the dark with headlamps, knowing that the sun's going to come up, but we want to make sure that we get back down to that camp before dark. So we reverse our plan. You know, our departure is based on when we want to get back to that camp. So we start climbing. I'd never been to these altitudes before. My partner was using oxygen. I was climbing without. I was doing fine. And with every step I took, I was breaking a personal altitude record. And as you go higher, right, you go slower and slower simply because of the lack of oxygen. And things went really well for the first 10 hours of that climb. And we find ourselves then 300 vertical feet away from the summit. And that final 300-foot summit ridge is still going to take about 2 hours of climbing just to gain 300 feet. Because at those altitudes, you're going pretty slow. And at that point, we were standing here, and the weather, we could tell, was deteriorating. A storm was coming. It was getting windier. It was starting to snow, losing visibility. And we had a decision to make at this point as to what to do. We knew the risk was increasing. And because of those deteriorating conditions, we decided at that point that we had to stop and we had to turn around. 300 feet from the summit. You know, we figured we could get to the summit, but with the weather conditions, we predicted that we could possibly die on the way down. And we didn't think that would be a good idea. So imagine, you know, but we listened to the mountain. And this is the rule that I'd learned, and this is the rule that I followed. 300 feet from the top. And imagine what a lot of other people do in that situation. What do you think they do? They keep going, right? They've spent time, energy, money. They've already told people they're going to climb Everest. They're not willing to turn around, and they're not willing to listen to the mountain. It's a hard thing to do, and we did it. So, you know, are you disappointed? Certainly, but that's the rules of engagement. And we come home from a trip like that, and people go, oh, you failed. You know, I don't look at that as a failure. If you've done your best, prepared, planned, trained, if something prevents you from success, that's not a failure. It's just a non-success. And it's a learning experience. And you say, okay, it didn't happen today. That mountain's going to be there forever. I'll just go back. And I never said I have to go back. I always said, oh, I get to go back. Once again, I enjoyed the process. So there was my first Everest expedition non-success. I went back the next year to the east side of Everest, very challenging, extremely dangerous, walked away in the face of risk. So there's two strikes against me now on Everest. But from 1987 on then, I was in what I call the big leagues of mountaineering. At that point on, I went on at least one Himalayan expedition every year for the next 20 years. So I was kind of in the thick of it, and this I was living my dream. My third expedition in 89, was to another mountain. This was not Everest. This is a mountain called Kanchenjunga, third highest peak in the world, 28,200 feet roughly. And even though Everest is the highest, we don't always look at it as the hardest. This is 3,000 feet of ice that we had to climb on our way to the summit of Kanchenjunga. And after 3 months of effort, three of us now got to the top of Kanchenjunga. And for me, this was one of the highlights of my career, my very first summit of an 8,000 meter peak. And when you're on the top, you know, we're in this little island in the sky. And on a good day, which we had, and we had enough time, we can hang out for about an hour. And you got to remember, this is roughly cruising altitude, you know, of a jet. So when you're flying home today or tomorrow, you know, at cruising altitude, look out the window, and there's a couple of guys out there waving at you. That's where we're hanging out. And if the weather's nice, you know, one of the rewards is this amazing view that we get. And they're looking 80 miles off to the west, just left of center, is Everest. So you think, you know, you celebrate on the summit, right? Because you've achieved your goal. You kind of want to. Yeah, you shake hands and you high five a little bit. But I've always tempered that knowing on the summit, I'm actually only half done with what I set out to do because you still have to go down. And a lot of people lose sight of that. You know, they get to the summit, they celebrate, they let down their guard, you know, the climb is over. And in a lot of cases, people have expended all of their energy, they've used all their daylight, and they used all their oxygen just to get to the summit. And most accidents and deaths occur not on the way up, but on the way down, because people haven't planned for the descent. I always plan my descent even before I think about my ascent. So I reverse plan. You know, a climb isn't a climb until you're taking your boots off down at base camp. And you got to think about that. So finally, 1990, my third trip to Everest. We climbed along that west, that left-hand skyline. 8 weeks into that climb, I once again had the opportunity to try to go for the summit. And on this particular climb, I was alone on that final summit day. It's just the way the logistics worked out. And I thought to myself, okay, I have the technical ability. I don't need to be roped up to anybody. But to be alone up here and climb to a summit of one of these mountains for 12 hours, I mean, that's the challenging part. And in fact, it ended up being the hardest day of my life. Because for 12 hours, there's nobody to help me kick a trail into the snow. There's nobody to help make decisions. There's nobody to motivate with, right? And I had to be very focused and very determined. And at these altitudes, believe it or not, without oxygen, for every step I took, I stood there and breathed 15 times. And you take another step and you stand there and you breathe 15 times. And that's all you do all day long. You know, to go to the width of this room at those altitudes could take a half an hour. So you have to be very patient. And you can't be overwhelmed by the immensity of that 12-hour day. It's too big of a thing to think about. So you have to break it down into smaller, tangible goals. You know, I'm going to climb to that rock 100 feet away. And once I get to that rock, I'm going to pick another goal and pick another goal. But it's really hard, and you're suffering. I mean, it's not fun at that point. You're gasping for air. You got snot frozen on your face. And you're kind of asking yourself, why am I doing this? And you're starting to think about an excuse to quit. because it is so hard. And you think, oh, I could go home and turn around and say it was too hard or it was too cold or I wasn't having fun, right? In the moment, those are good options. They're great excuses. But if you quit early, how do you feel tomorrow? And I had really no legitimate excuses. So I said, I'm going to keep going and keep going. And finally, 12 hours into that day, I took those last steps. And this is the view then that opened up in front of me from the top of the world. It was an amazing moment for me to have, you know, having grown up in the flattest state in the United States and now standing on the summit of Everest, having climbed it without oxygen. And to be up there alone is very rare, very unique, kind of cool, but I thought, not so cool. Who's going to take my picture, right? But I had a plan. I have an ice axe. I stuck it in the snow vertically and balanced my camera. This was 1990, so it wasn't an iPhone. It wasn't digital. It was film. I had to set the aperture, and I had to set the focus, and I turned on the timer. And then I ran into position, and I got my own selfie then on the summit of Everest. But I didn't know if that selfie turned out until a month later I get home and got the film developed, right? That's how careful you had to be in those days taking a photo. But one of the highlights of my life, you know, being there on the summit of Everest and having climbed it without oxygen. Again, one of the hardest days of my life, but extremely rewarding. So I thought to myself, well, what do I do now? Am I done climbing? I mean, you could end a career climbing Everest, right? And walk away and have a normal life and have a normal job, which I decided not to do. I said, what do I want to do now? How do I take what I've learned and the experience that I've gained and do something even harder, right? And that's the interesting part. Keep doing something hard, keep doing something challenging. And I decided my next goal would be to climb this mountain called K2. Second highest mountain in the world, only 700 feet lower than Everest. But by all means, we call this the Holy Grail of mountaineering. Probably the hardest mountain in the world to climb. Very steep, very technical. It gets the brunt of the weather. It's in the far western part of Pakistan. And very rarely in those days was K2 successfully climbed. And we went there in 1992, and I partnered up with a friend of mine from Seattle, Scott Fisher. And we said, we're going to stay together as a two-man team, and we're going to integrate ourselves with the team that was there. So this is in Pakistan, and from there we tried to coordinate our efforts with an international group of climbers. And when you go to K2, I mean, you literally do battle with this mountain. The terrain is very steep. This is about 45 degrees on average from bottom to top. And the camps are very precarious. You know, there's no flat spot to camp on K2. You basically chop a ledge, you put a tent up, and you have to be very careful walking around one of these camps. And knowing that we're going to go up and down this steep terrain, you know, day in and day out carrying loads and building camps, on a lot of these steeper sections, we'll fix a rope to the mountain, anchor it into the rock or anchor it into the ice. And that provides a hand line, a safety line that allows us to efficiently reascend terrain that we've already climbed. But more importantly, in bad weather or in storms or in the case of a rescue, we have this line that we can follow on our way back down, this fixed rope, we call it. So I'd done my homework on K2. I'd read about the history. I knew how hard it was going to be. I knew how long it could take. I knew all the bad stuff that could happen. And it happened to us. We had avalanches. We had storms. We were involved in rescues. And this climb went on and on and on. And finally, 10, 12 weeks into this, most of the team started to give up and to go home because they were a little bit blindsided. They said, man, this is taking too long. Man, this is way harder than I thought. They hadn't prepared themselves for how long and how hard this was going to be. So a lot of people left. Either they didn't want to be there. A lot of them had normal jobs to get back to, commitments that they had. And it was because their plane ticket said, you're departing on such and such a date, they left. You know, I go on a lot of these expeditions and I don't even buy a return ticket because I don't want that ticket to tell me when to go home. I want to go home when I'm done trying to climb the mountain. So a handful of us stayed. We finally had a break in the weather, which we had very few of. And Scott and I finally, for the first time, managed to set up Camp 4. This is now at 26,000 feet. And from this camp now, we hope that we are only one day away from getting to the top of K2. 2,000 feet of climbing ahead of us. And the steepest part of the mountain. I mean, this mountain is relentless. The higher you go, the harder it gets, the steeper it gets. That's why it's so hard to climb. So this is the night before our final climb, right? And what do you do that night? Well, you're kind of busy. You got to melt snow to make water. You really have no appetite at these altitudes. So you might split a power bar, and that's your dinner. And then you start preparing for the following day, which is going to be probably the biggest day of your life. You're excited, you're nervous, you're anxious. You know, what's going to happen tomorrow? And we set the alarm for 1 a.m, hoping that we're going to get out the door and just start climbing. But that night, a storm came in, and during the night, 3 feet of snow fell. And this is what we woke up to. We had to get up every hour to shovel the snow off the tent to keep it from collapsing. And we woke up and we said, it's way too dangerous. There's no way we can climb to the summit today. What should we do? Well, we're kind of trapped here at 26,000 feet. You know, you're not getting stronger. You're actually getting weaker. You're deteriorating. What do we do? We talked about going down, escaping down those fixed ropes to the safety of base camp. But we thought if we go down, we're not going to come back up. It's been too hard. It's taken too long. We either go down and forget about it or we wait. And together then we decided to wait. And we stayed here together in this little tiny tent, you know, the size of a single bed for 3 days. This is where you really have to like who you're with, right? And in my infinite wisdom to save weight, we only brought one sleeping bag. So we zipped it open and used it like a blanket. So, you know, what do you do for 3 days? You don't eat. You have no appetite. You don't have a book. There's no iPad. There's no music. You know, I'd been with Scott for 3 months. There's nothing left to talk about. And you just wait and wonder what's going to happen. But that patience paid off. After waiting for 3 days, we got that window of opportunity. I mean, you've got to be at the right place to take advantage of that opportunity. And then we got that window that we were waiting for. And from that camp then, it took us 10 hours, and we finally got to the summit of K2. So the lessons and the takeaways I got from this mountain was to be patient, to be persistent, and to be comfortable being uncomfortable, right? You can't start complaining about how uncomfortable it is or how long you have to wait, because it'll pay off. And that's what we walked away from after having climbed K2. So after that event now, I'd had climbed the 3 highest mountains in the world. And I hadn't really planned on that, right? It was opportunities and it was invitations. And I thought, what do I want to do now? This had been kind of random. And I knew I wanted to climb more peaks. And then I thought, why not climb all 14 of these 8,000ers, you know, like as a project? I'd done 3. There's only 11 left. And I said, this is my plan. This is my commitment. And I called it Endeavor 8000. And I said, here I go. And I told people about it. It's like, this is what I'm going to do. How long is it going to take? I don't know, 10 years, 15 years. I don't care. I didn't give myself a time limit. So I had a plan. I knew I had the desire and the skill. What I didn't have, though, was the money. I thought, how am I going to pay for all this stuff? You know, I was no longer working as a veterinarian because I got fired. I wasn't around enough. I was living in a basement working as a carpenter. But I did have some support. I was working with a lot of outdoor product people. I was working with a new company called Expedia out of Seattle. And they were giving me free product, right? In return, I would give them photos and stuff. But I had a garage full of stuff. And I had to kind of go back to them and say, listen, we have a relationship. I like your product. Thank you very much. But if you want me to continue using your great product, you now have to pay me. I need money. I need cash, right, to live and to buy stuff and support myself as a climber. But in return of your investment in me, I will give you something in return. I'll work for you. You know, I'll help design and develop. I'll go to trade shows. I'll do sales meetings. I'll be a spokesperson, a poster boy. As long as I could show these investors that they were getting a return, that's how I created long-term relationships with these companies. And I didn't have one giant sponsor. You know, I had a whole bunch of little guys. So that was like my portfolio. And because the money that you get from these companies is, you know, it's from marketing, you end up looking, you know, like a race car driver, right? You got the logos and the caps and the flags. But that's then how I learned how to become a professional climber, by working with a bunch of other people. And they supported me and they helped me do what I did. And the next thing I thought, okay, who's going to be my team? Who do I want to go do these adventures with for the next 10 or 15 years? You know, and keeping 6 or 8 or 10 people together, which I'd been used to for that long, I thought was going to be challenging. Why not find one other person out there that's doing what I'm doing in the same way? That would be the perfect partnership. And I thought the first priority of that one other partner, you know, two people can be a team, is I have to like you. Because if I don't like you at sea level, I'm not going to like you at 26,000 feet. And also implicit trust, right? We're connected. We're roped together in this dangerous arena. And if we don't trust each other's skill set, there's no reason to rope up. And in 1995, I met and was introduced to the guy on in the dark jacket, a climber from Finland named Veikka Gustafsson. He was out there doing what I was doing, climbing without oxygen. I liked him. I trusted him. And in Finland, he was a big deal. He was the first Finn to climb Everest. And in a country of 5 million people, you know, he was a superstar. People were naming their kids after Veikka. He had his own action figure. You know, so, and one of the accessories was a Yeti that came with his action figure. So financially, he could support his half of all these expeditions, and I would support my half. So that was, I thought, the perfect partnership. And we then became a two-man team and climbed together for the next 10 years. And we said, we want to have fun, we want to be safe, we want to keep this simple. And we had a lot of success, you know, and we simplified everything. Just two of us climbing these mountains as a two-man team. We don't need a giant entourage. We never brought the media. We had a minimal amount of equipment. So it was inexpensive and it was efficient. And very importantly, we were successful. For every 3 expeditions we went on, 2 were successful. So 2 out of 3 is pretty good. And for me, very importantly, we were safe. Not once in our entire, or my entire 30-year career, did I have an accident. I never needed a rescue, never got an injury. And more importantly, none of my teammates ever lost their lives. And that, again, is very rare in this Himalayan arena. Imagine getting on a plane with 6 other climbing partners and 3 months later coming home with an empty seat on the plane. That's a very, very common occurrence. And I'm so proud never to have had that happen to me. Safety was a priority. And again, we had success and we were fun. But there were lumps and bumps in our road as well. You know, we weren't always successful. For instance, this is a mountain in Pakistan called Broad Peak, a little over 27,000 feet. You know, we spent 2 months on this thing. And on our way to the summit, we were forced to stop 100 vertical feet away from the top based on dangerous avalanche conditions. And we walked away 100 feet from the top. So you can imagine what I call these external pressures that could affect how you make a choice at this point. You know, I was well along into my career. I was getting close to finishing all of these peaks. So I had my own expectations and my own pressures to keep pushing as well, let alone the sponsors that I had that were supporting me, that wanted me to succeed, let alone the media that started to follow me, let alone the fan base. And a lot of those external pressures can affect then how you make your decisions. And people in risky environments, day in and day out, also have a tendency to become complacent. You become comfortable with the risk. You're like, nothing's ever happened. It's not going to happen. Today I'm going to take a shortcut. I want to succeed. I'm going to step over the line. I want to be faster. I want to save some money and get home earlier. And in a dangerous arena, construction industry, medical industry, people are tempted to start taking shortcuts for the sake of success. And I felt those pressures. And I said to myself, I need to put blinders on and say, I'm doing this for me. I'm not doing it for anybody else. I don't care what other people think, whether it's positive or negative. And I think you've got to be true to yourself and remember your foundation about how you learn to do what you do. And remember that it's all about being patient and waiting for the right conditions. You know, if it doesn't happen today, it doesn't happen this year, keep going and it'll happen tomorrow. It'll happen next year. And so Vaik and I went down, came back a few years later, and we reclimbed 99.99% of the mountain and climbed that last 100 feet and got to the top. So once again, it's all about being patient and persistent. And I kept going on this journey, you know, year after year, beautiful mountains all over Asia, you know, Pakistan, Nepal, Tibet. And eventually, 17 years into this journey, I'd climbed 13 of the 14 mountains, and I had one mountain left. The last mountain, Annapurna. Remember, this is the mountain I read about as a kid. And people thought, oh, you left Annapurna for the end. And I said, no, I already tried it twice. This turns out to be the most dangerous of these 8,000 meter peaks. Out of 180 people only that had climbed it, 60 had died. One out of three. And I had attempted it twice already earlier in my career and saw how dangerous this mountain was. Based on its architecture, it's got avalanches that shower down all of its faces, unpredictably. So you can't control the risk on this mountain. And I thought to myself, after those two attempts, I was afraid of this mountain. I'd never been afraid of a mountain before, but this one was off the charts, dangerous. And I thought, no matter how smart or safe or trained I am, I can't control the risk. And for a long time, I convinced myself not to go back. I said, I'm okay. I did 13 out of 14. Who else cares, right? I'm not going to get a medal. There's no trophy. There's no bonus check. Just let it go, you know? Because I thought, if I go to Annapurna and die, that's not going to look good on my resume, right? But me being me and being stubborn and not wanting to not finish stuff, I decided I've got to go back. For a third try. You know, maybe conditions will be good. And I won't know unless I'm there. But at least I'll go there with a plan. If conditions are just as bad as I think they'll be, I'll come home. But I'll know I made the right choice. So Vaik and I talked about it. We're going to go again for the third time. And I didn't make that decision lightly. At that point, I'd been married for 10 years. I had two kids at home to think about. But believe it or not, my wife trusted me and she believed in me to the point where it's like she never said no. She knew what I was doing. She knew that I made smart, safe decisions. She knew something could happen, but she allowed me to do what I did. And she became part of my team, right? When you walk out of your door and you go to work, you've got a team at home cheering you on. And that's what she did for me. And I thank her for that. So the spring of 2005, Vaik and I, we go back. This is now our third trip to Annapurna. What's going to happen? We don't know. And we promised everyone and ourselves as well, we're going to go there, we're going to sit there, we're going to watch the mountain, and we're going to listen to it. It's going to tell us, go or no go. And lo and behold, conditions were absolutely phenomenal that year. It was colder, the mountain was glued together, and somehow we were at the right place at the right time. And that's when we decided to go for it. And this was not an easy climb. You know, there was some steep terrain. The hazards were minimal, so I felt comfortable. And finally, you know, we set up our high camp. This is a day's climb now from the top of Annapurna. And this was an amazing place to be. I'm one day away now from finishing this 18-year project. Did we get to go to the next day? No. A storm came in, and we were stuck once again at this camp for 2 days. So Annapurna didn't let me go easily. But finally, on May 12, 2005, together we took those last steps, and together then we got to the top of Annapurna. For me, this was the literal dream come true. You know, this vision that I had, this goal that I had, something that took 18 years. Somehow I made it. You know, I didn't give up. I didn't quit. I didn't die. And I finished what I set out to do. And that was one of the proudest days of my life. Again, me and my partner sitting up there. And you don't get a reward. You know, it's the satisfaction of knowing you finished something you set out to do. That, for me, was the biggest reward of all. And I look back then on Annapurna. You know, I didn't plan for it to be the end. But I'm glad it was, because it was the hardest challenge of my climbing career. And I needed 30 years of experience to not only succeed, but to survive that Annapurna event. You know, and I think you're all going to have some Annapurna in your life, in your career, where you're going to say, I'm ready for this. I might not have been ready for it 5 years ago, but today I am ready for this challenge. So for me, it came at the right point. And then obviously poetically, you know, this book that I read that literally put me on this path, my life now comes full circle. I'll leave you now with the last sentence of this book. Again, the book that changed my life, that inspired me. And pictured on the cover is the leader of the climb, Maurice Herzog, who led from the front. You know, he led by example. He carried the loads. He broke trail just like everybody else. And in the end was one of the two that reached the top. And you see him now flying his flag on the summit. And to do that, it was cold. It was windy. He took his gloves off to do that. And he lay his gloves in the snow, and then he watched them slide into the abyss. He didn't have a backup pair of gloves. And he'd already frozen his toes on his way to the summit. So he knew he was probably going to get toes amputated. And because of his hands were frozen, sliding down all those fixed ropes over the next 3 or 4 days literally shredded the tissue off of his fingers and had all 10 fingers amputated as well. So that's a huge price to pay for success, right? We all have a different price we're willing to pay for success. He lost all 10 fingers. He lost all 10 toes. I never was willing to pay that price. I have all my digits. But he said that Annapurna changed his life in a positive way. So for him, it was worth it. And I'm glad he wrote that book, because his book changed my life in a positive way. And also because of his book, I always carried an extra pair of gloves, right? So you learn from others. But the last sentence of his book is, he says, we all have our own Annapurna. That's the last sentence. And I think that's a great message. It's a great metaphor. The horizon of your life is a bumpy series of mountains, right? This year you've climbed to a certain altitude. Next year, do you want to go to the same altitude? No, you want to climb higher. You want to grow. You want to push. You want to grow your business. And that means working even harder. And how do you get motivated for that? You're like, oh, I'm so tired already. How do I work even harder? But that, again, is embracing the process and not being overwhelmed by something that's really hard and challenging and big, but saying, I'm going to do what I do today. And tomorrow I'm going to worry about tomorrow and the next day and the next day. And that's the way you incrementally gain success. Obviously, some days, some years, you kill it, right? You keep growing, you go far, but sometimes you don't go anywhere. And sometimes you actually feel like you went backwards. But that's not when you give up, right? You say, okay, I need to regroup. We need to rethink, wait for that window of opportunity. And that's when you move forward. So you set that goal. And you know that teamwork is essential. You know, as a team, as a partnership, as collaborators, you unify and you create synergy, right? The people that work with you help you to grow. The people that work with you help to elevate you. Your partners, your coworkers, your family, your friends, right? All of that partnership. And there's patience, and there's persistence, and there's planning, and there's preparation. But I think the number one key ingredient to challenging endeavors is passion, right? Find something that you love to do, and you'll do it forever. And you won't complain about how hard it is or how long it takes, because you're going to embrace the process. So thank you very much for having me, and I wish you success. Thank you.